Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the public testimony today by President Trump's former personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, before the House Oversight Committee, in which Cohen expressed his contrition and shame for having been blindly loyal in protecting and promoting Trump for 10 years while concealing his illicit acts, knowing that, quote, Trump is a racist, is a con man, and is a cheat. Lisa Graves, co-director of Documented, who served in all three branches of the federal government as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief Counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a Deputy Chief for the U.S. Courts, joins us to analyze today's testimony. We will discuss the credible evidence Cohen presented in the explosive revelations that Trump knew in advance of the WikiLeaks data dump the Russians hacked from the DNC, that Trump violated campaign finance laws in arranging payments of hush money, and that Trump was paying off Cohen and involved in the deal to get a Trump Tower built in Moscow while he was in the White House. And since Cohen mentioned that the Southern District of New York investigators are looking into more crimes that might implicate Trump, we will look ahead to whether the Tea Party Republicans who tried to derail today's hearings will be able to shout down the mounting evidence against their leader they blindly defend. Then, following testimony from an insider who was close to Trump for 10 years, we'll get an analysis of the kind of person Trump is, as described by his personal lawyer and fixer Michael Cohen, and speak with Lance Dodis, a training and supervising analyst emeritus with the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute, who was a clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Dodis is a contributor, along with 36 others, to the new updated book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 37 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President, and joins us to analyze this person described today as a racist, con man, and a cheat. Then finally, we'll get an assessment of today's second summit meeting in Hanoi, Vietnam, between President Trump and Kim Jong-un, and speak with Michael Fuchs, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who served as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia and Pacific Affairs. He joins us to discuss his article at The Guardian, Is Progress with North Korea Possible Under Trump's Style of Diplomacy?, and whether the ambitious agenda the White House is signaling that's on the table can result in a deal which could be enacted and verified. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Lisa Graves, co-director of Documented, a watchdog group that investigates how corporations manipulate public policy, harming our environment, communities, and democracy. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief Counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a Deputy Chief for the U.S. Courts. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lisa Graves.
Hi, Ian. Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, thanks, Lisa. And did you spend your day glued to the TV?
I did watch all of it. I didn't watch it all at the same time. I had to take a bit of a break and come back to it. It was quite the spectacle in lots of ways. I think it was important for there to be a hearing with Mr. Cohen's testimony, and for the American people to hear from him himself about what he observed from Donald Trump, and also what his concerns are about Trump.
But as much as it was a first opportunity just to have an insider testify before the public, it was so clear that the Republicans were simply trying to derail it, thwart it, and do anything they could. And actually, they started out by trying to stop it altogether, and that the Democrats were trying to at least get him to say what he wanted to say. So, you know, what does it say about our politics? I guess that answers itself, doesn't it? But it's sort of pathetic, isn't it? I thought the Tea Party Republicans, who seemed to dominate that Republican side of the House Judiciary Committee, were just, you know, they were like the Fox News hosts. They were just like junkyard dogs, just yapping and barking. And they were literally trying to frustrate and distract. So I guess the question that, that I posed in the opening, Lisa, is how long can they do that in the face of this mounting evidence?
Well, I think that they appear to have infinite capacity to basically do whatever Trump wants. It is a bit astonishing. I have to say that there was a moment where I wondered whether Trump University had come back to life and it was offering really bad acting and debating classes for these guys, because Jim Jordan, Mark Meadows, the tone of their questions, the theatrical approach that they took, really compound questions, deliberately argumentative questions. They managed to make Michael Cohen, who is in fact convicted of lying, convicted of a number of crimes, and about to go to prison, they made him look even more sympathetic, which is a pretty difficult feat in a certain way. And they did it while the women on that committee as well, on the Republican side, the men and women of that on the Republican side, were sort of shocking in their attack on Cohen as a liar, all the while that they have defended Trump's lies after lie after lie after lie. They were, you know, in high dudgeon about Michael Cohen profiting somehow from the presidency based on some of the evidence that's come forward, and they've expressed no such concern about the president himself, about Trump himself profiting from this presidency in numerous ways, not the least of which is through the Trump Hotel there in D.C., but in so many other ways, through his family, through the deals they've cut with foreign governments and more. And so, you know, it was sort of astonishing to see these Republicans express such concern about the waste of taxpayer dollars after they spent millions and millions of dollars on Benghazi, and they have not held a single real hearing into Donald Trump. Certainly on the House side, they have done everything they can to help him cover up his misconduct, and this was just more of the same.
Well, they certainly pounded on the idea that he's a convicted felon, and they enumerated the charges against him for tax avoidance, and I guess I don't know what the actual term is for not properly declaring your taxes, but that struck me as a major, major irony, because here they are going after Michael Cohen, but they've never raised a word about Donald Trump handing over his taxes.
Exactly. The hypocrisy, I don't even know that we need a new word for the level of hypocrisy the Republicans are willing to engage in. You have a president who has refused to turn over his taxes, a president who has repeatedly and notoriously lied about his income, someone who has been involved in multiple bankruptcies, worked over or screwed over, in essence, numerous contractors, and yet all of this ire directed at Cohen by the same people who've been, in essence, sort of politically aiding and abetting Trump this whole way through. I think, you know, what you're seeing in some ways is another manifestation of this fracturing of our country, where you have some Republican members who are from such safe seats that are dominated by people who are so enthralled with Donald Trump's power or persona, so gullible to believe Fox News, virtually all of Fox News's claims and repetition of the president's claims, that they feel safe and emboldened to behave this way. They behaved, I think, in ways that were embarrassing to Congress, to its history. And Congress does, in fact, have a history of bringing people before it who have taken the responsibility for their crimes, who have provided testimony about other people who committed bigger crimes. It's not unprecedented for you to have someone come before you who's an imperfect witness, who has been convicted, who has been cooperating with the prosecutors, because that's the nature of our criminal justice system. And people then, and Congress certainly has the right as well, to try to find out more about what's happening behind the scenes and what evidence this witness has to bear. And I think Michael Cohen brought forward a number of pieces of evidence, actual documentary evidence, to show how much Trump has misled the American people.
And again, I'm speaking with Lisa Graves, who's the co-director of Documented, a watchdog group that investigates how corporations manipulate public policy, harming our environment, communities, and democracy. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as deputy assistant attorney general in the Justice Department, as chief counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a deputy chief for the U.S. courts. So in terms of the sort of bombshells that were dropped today, one, of course, that Roger Stone was on the speakerphone listening in with Trump and Cohen when he told Trump that WikiLeaks was about to do a data dump of what the Russians hacked from the DNC. That struck me as being pretty damaging. And, of course, the extent to which the evidence was provided through those checks signed by Donald Trump and by Donald Jr. and Weisselberg, that Trump's violated campaign finance laws in arranging payments of hush money. And then, of course, the third one that happened while Trump was in the White House. One was he was paying off Cohen, and two, that he was is still involved in the deal to get a Trump Tower built in Moscow, which he said had stopped during the campaign. So just take those as you will and how you see them in what order of jeopardy.
Well, I think that the Democrats were able through this hearing to elicit more details about some of those circumstances, to elicit more details about the role of Trump in the payoff that occurred right before the election. The American people had no idea that Trump had been accused in that way by Stormy Daniels of his, you know, of this affair. And they worked so at such length to hide it from the American people. And they did so in a way to try to evade the public's knowledge of it, to make sure that it wasn't, to do it in a way to try to not have it be disclosed as a payment that would be disclosable from the campaign. Those are violations of the law. That's illegal to do. And it's quite clear, as Michael Cohen said, that the president is individual one in that plea agreement, in that discussion of those crimes. Those are crimes. And so I think that's significant. You have that testimony, you have his plea, and you have more details about Trump's role in that. I think that's significant. And I think that there are other details that came out, as you point out, the fact that the payments were going on after Trump was sworn in, that they had this elaborate payment arrangement to try to, again, conceal from the American people what Trump had done and what he had orchestrated to try to win this race. I also think the question of WikiLeaks and Roger Stone is obviously continues to be very important. But I also would say, Ian, that I think that the questions of AOC, of the new congresswoman from New York, were particularly poignant in terms of this question about will this president leave office peacefully? And Michael Cohen was very clear about his concerns that Trump would not do so. My friend David Halperin has called for there to be a commission, a bipartisan commission, to ensure an orderly transition in government, to have some mechanisms in place to deal with that risk. A lot of people have a deep fear of that risk, that Donald Trump would not leave quietly if he does not win in 2020. And I think it's a substantial threat to our democracy.
And what about what Cohen sort of almost said as an aside, that the Southern District of New York investigators were looking into more crimes that Trump may have committed?
Yes, I think that was also very revealing, that there were multiple additional criminal investigations or lines of inquiry that the Southern District of New York is pursuing. It's not clear all the people who may be implicated in that, but it seems pretty clear that some of that may well involve Trump and the Trump organization, perhaps the Trump family. It's not likely to be about Michael Cohen alone himself, since he's already pleaded and he's getting ready to go serve his sentence. So that's significant, especially with all of the talk and speculation that the Independent Counsel investigation is about to wrap up. I don't think it actually is about to wrap up. I would speculate that it's not. There's so many things outstanding, including the Roger Stone indictment. There's an outstanding set of issues related to one of the Russian companies in terms of the grand jury proceedings that have been covered in the press, and there's certainly more to investigate here. But I am very glad that Congress is taking the first steps to begin an examination of that House of Representatives engaged in really malpractice by failing to have hearings into these matters over these past 2 years. So I'm very glad that Congressman Cummings, the Chairman Cummings, has held this meeting, this committee hearing today, and that the American people have a chance to hear for themselves and see for themselves some of the mounting evidence about Donald Trump and his fitness for office, his actual unfitness for office.
And what do you think was going on with Cohen and the Russian questions? We were told in advance that they weren't really going to deal with Russia. It was sort of off the table, but it came up a couple of times. And from what he said, he was sort of indicating that it may not be quite as big a story as a lot of people think it is. So what did you make of what he had to say about the Russian story?
I thought it was very interesting in the sense that his written testimony and his oral testimony was confirming that Trump knew about that Russia meeting, that meeting in Trump Tower with a government attorney who's, you know, closely tied to Putin, the meeting that Donald Trump Jr., you know, boasted about being great. It'd be great to get this dirt on Hillary Clinton. That was the meeting that the White House lied about, that Donald Trump apparently directed the statement to lie to the American people about what that meeting was regarding, basically saying it was about adoptions, not what it was really about. So I think that Cohen shed additional light on that issue. But it seems clear that there is certainly more that the intelligence committees and certainly the House Intelligence Committee under Adam Schiff, Chairman Schiff, is looking into. And there was apparently a desire to set those matters aside to preserve them for the intelligence committees' purview, perhaps in closed session in addition to open session. So I think we have more to hear about that in the coming weeks and months.
Yeah, I had the feeling that maybe he was, didn't want to step on Mueller's investigation or the testimony he's giving tomorrow to Adam Schiff or the testimony he gave yesterday to the Senate Intelligence Committee. But still, the idea that that he didn't go to Prague, which is pretty central to Christopher Steele's dossier. What did you make of that?
Well, I think at this point there's either evidence or there's no evidence of that. Mm-hmm. I think we'll know pretty soon whether the denial is in fact valid. But just given the fact that that Michael Cohen has to testify honestly, in essence, to be consistent with his agreement for his plea to the crimes that he has committed, I would be surprised if he was testifying falsely now on that point. I'm not sure that that's so central to the broader Russian allegations in terms of the Steele dossier. It certainly was a highly covered issue. When you look at that Steele dossier, the descriptions of it and the details that have come out from it, that's Steele reporting back about what he's hearing. It's sort of the breadcrumbs that an investigator is hearing. It could well have been another person within the Trump campaign who was that person, that it was mistaken for being Cohen. I think we don't know. But what we do know is there are other parts of that dossier that have, I think, been validated by evidence. And I also think that there is more to the story well beyond that dossier, in the sense that Michael Cohen may not have been central to those parts of the campaign's activities. It sounds like, that Stone and Trump himself were very closely aligned, as the movies about Stone talk about, as others have talked about their close alignment. And there are also, maybe other people who were more directly engaged. Michael Cohen was not one of the people that Donald Trump Jr. invited to that Russia meeting in Trump Tower. So I don't think that he's as central to that set of allegations as he is central to other allegations.
So just in the last 30 seconds then, Do you think what you heard today in the testimony before the House Oversight Committee, do you think there was enough evidence put forth to convict Donald Trump in a court of law, not just impeachment, but convictions in a court of law?
I think on some of those issues, there's plenty of evidence that a jury could find Donald Trump to have definitely sought to evade campaign finance law, to do so illegally, to violate our federal election laws. I think there's sufficient evidence for such a finding of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt if you have a properly, fairly chosen jury.
Well, Lisa Graves, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Ian.
Thanks again. And I've been speaking with Lisa Graves, who's co-director of Documented, a watchdog group that investigates how corporations manipulate public policy, harming our environment, communities, and democracy. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as deputy assistant attorney general in the Justice Department, as chief counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a deputy chief for the U.S. courts. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into who this person described as a racist, con man, and a cheat is.
Real friends, how many of us, how many of us, how many jealous? Real friends, there's not many of us, we smile at each other, but how many honest? Trust issues, switch up the number, I can't be bothered, I cannot blame you for having an angle. Ain't got no issues, I'm just doing my thing. Hope you're doing your thing too. I'm a deadbeat cousin, I hate family.
I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. Even if he had to wrong someone, I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. Even if he had to wrong someone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Lance Dodis, who's a training and supervising analyst emeritus with the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute, who was a clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Dodis is a contributor along with 36 other psychiatrists and mental health experts who have contributed to a new book, Assessing President Trump, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 37 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President, now in an updated and expanded version with new essays. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lance Dodis.
Hi, Ian. It's good to be with you.
So thanks for joining us, Lance. And when you have somebody that knows President Trump well, who's been with him 10 years in that very kind of hermetic little Trump organization. It's a very small group of people, family business. He's only trusts one or two outsiders, Cohen and his accountant, Weisselberg, and his family. So there's no question that Cohen knows this man well. As well or better than most people. What do you make of the weight of what he said today about the person?
Well, I think it's all correct. And the interesting thing to me is that although the Republicans on the committee tried to discredit him, everything he said has an enormous amount of evidence in its favor from 1,000 other sources. It isn't as though he's saying anything that we don't already know. So the fact that he lies, for example, I mean, it's a fact. We know that. The fact that he cheats people, we know that. The fact that he's a con man, that was something that the Mayor Bloomberg, I believe, said at the Democratic National Convention in 2016, because he knew him also. But we know that from 1,000 things that he's done. So, you know, the Republicans want to discredit him for their own reasons, but I think what he said is not remarkable. It's interesting to hear him say it, but he didn't say anything that we don't already know and that we don't already have evidence of.
Well, one of the things that that had been previewed, I don't know who, Lenny Davis or somebody, was suggesting that Cohen may really expose the, you know, like in the last scene of the Wizard of Oz, pull back the curtain and show us who this man really is. I've always understood, and I did my homework before he became president when he was running, talked to a bunch of businessmen who dealt with him, and they all said it was impossible to be with him. He's just completely insane. He's in his own world. It's embarrassing. He just talks about himself. He's delusional. They couldn't wait to get out of the meetings. I mean, and you hear that from White House reporters, that everybody around him in the White House just are running around in fear, because this person that you see on a daily basis, not what the public sees, but what they see on the inside, is just frightening. And Cohen did make an allusion to that today. He didn't say the president is a madman, which is what Lanny Davis and company were implying he would probably say. But what he did say was that the worst characteristics that this man have gotten a lot worse since he's become president.
Oh, yes. And we predicted that when he was elected. It's a question of his character. Part of the problem with the word madman is that it's confused with what he really has. There are, first of all, madman is not a technical diagnosis, needless to say, but people get mixed up between folks who have a serious biological mental illness like schizophrenia and people who have a personality disorder, which is what he has. And they have absolutely nothing to do with each other. So if you wanted to say that some people are mad in the sense that they are psychotic, they think that, you know, the little green men are controlling them or something of that nature, that's not Donald Trump. Actually, what Donald Trump has is far worse in a leader of a country, or somebody who has weapons. He's a psychopath, or the official diagnosis is antisocial personality. So unlike many people with actual mental illness who are perfectly decent and wonderful folks, he is not perfectly decent or wonderful. He has a fundamental flaw in the ability to have a conscience or to empathize with other human beings. That's a far more dangerous condition for somebody who controls nuclear weapons or is supposedly in charge of a democracy. So I think what they're describing is true. And again, we've seen it many, many times. And he fits every aspect of the official diagnostic description. And the fact that he gets worse is understandable, because a person as primitive as he is, primitive in the sense that he's developmentally ill, will always get worse if he is given more free rein. He becomes, in a sense, crazier and crazier. Again, it's not crazy in the sense that he thinks that people are controlling him from another planet, but crazy in the sense that his narcissistic grandiosity becomes more and more and more unhinged. So he, as he said when he was running for the presidency as a candidate, he said, only I can fix it. Well, anybody who says that should never be a president. I mean, you're talking about someone who has effectively a delusion about his greatness. And I think that's who he is, and that's why they can't stand to be with him.
But what is the distinction or the difference then between what you're describing as antisocial personality and character flaws, which is what I think Cohen said up front, Trump is a racist, a con man, and a cheat.
Yes. Well, all those things are true. And I mean, you don't have to be antisocial personality to be a racist. Lots of people are racist. But the con man is basically the lay term for antisocial personality disorder. I mean, a true con man, a person like Trump, is never considering, is never feeling any remorse or guilt for hurting other people, and is always looking out only for himself and looking to cheat people. That's what a con man does. He basically says, other people don't matter in my universe. Only I matter, and I will get what I want by cheating and lying and hurting other people. And it rolls off my back. I don't care. So all those things are consistent with who he is. And again, the point that he gets worse, yes, we knew he would get worse, and he will get worse still as pressure mounts. This was actually one of our greatest concerns when we wrote the book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. Our biggest concern was that he would start a war, because it's still possible, because the more stressed he is, the more he needs to do something to change reality, no matter who is hurt, even if it destroys everyone, in order to protect his sense of his wonderfulness and his greatness. So the war is the worst consequence, but we've already seen, of course, the other horrible consequences that he's trying to destroy democracy and would like to be a tyrant.
And again, I'm speaking with Lance Dodis, who's a training and supervising analyst emeritus with the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute, who was a clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Dodis is a contributor along with 36 other psychiatrists and mental health experts who have contributed to the new book, Assessing President Trump, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 37 psychiatrists and mental health experts assess a president. Well, apropos of what you just said, Lance, the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez asked, I thought, a very important question, which was, you know, is Trump, because Cohen said that he's definitely has autocratic tendencies. I'm not quoting them accurately, but something along those lines. And then she asked, would he, if he was defeated in 2020, would he leave office? And he said he wasn't sure that he would. That was a frightening moment.
Well, I agree that I'm not sure he would either. I think we are stronger as a nation, so that than other countries that have been taken over by tyrants. That I think he would be forced out. I don't think the even though Republicans have shown no stamina and no morality when it comes to Trump, I think eventually I don't think he would be allowed to stay. I think he would be carried out by the police. And incidentally, I think this is a guess on my part, but it would be fit with him. I think that his playing up the military, which he has done forever, you know, that he's going to make friends in the military, he's going to appoint military people and so forth. I think that he was aware on some level all along that if he was going to ever be able to take over as a tyrant of the United States, he would need the military to support him, as is true in other countries. So I think that's behind that, but I don't actually think it will work. Hitler got it to work in 1932 and dissolved the parliament, but we are stronger than the Weimar Republic was in Germany, and I don't think he'll be able to do it.
Well, that leads me to ask you for a diagnosis, if you will, of the Tea Party Republicans on the Republican side of the House Oversight Committee today. It was dominated by these Tea Party Republicans, the ranking member, of course, Jordan being one and Meadows being another. And they filibustered, they shouted, they were like junkyard dogs yapping in anger, you know, just the fury that they have. And they trot out these same old canards as though Hillary Clinton is president. You know, she's the devil, you know, and all the people that Trump has forced out, fired and forced out of the FBI, they're a part of some Hillary Clinton this is insane, absurd conspiracy that they throw out as though it was truth, at the same time refusing to look at everything and listen to what this guy was saying, who actually knows and was on the inside. So what's the pathology there? Why are they so angry?
Well, I don't know them, so I'd have to generalize. My guess is that there are two different components to it. The healthier part of it, I don't like it, but the healthier part of it is that they are political animals. They were elected to serve a right-wing agenda, and they are pursuing that, partly in order to curry favor with Trump, who's the leader of the party, and partly to curry favor with their constituents, and maybe they actually believe that nonsense themselves. But the more troubling part is that, it goes to the question of who are all these people who elected Donald Trump to begin with. So it's a mix. But some of them certainly needed a strong, even tyrannical leader emotionally. It's not unusual among human beings. I mean, people have always wanted to have strong leaders who they think of as omnipotent. They're kind of godlike figures, and lots of people would like that. Putin, has support in Russia. They want somebody to who they think it's like having a sports hero, you know, somebody they can identify with who they think is representing them, even though exactly the opposite is true. So some of these people may be like that, you know, and they say we must stand by this leader who we wish to be powerful, and we are going to support him. The other thing, which is more of a socioeconomic, is that to the extent that the Trump supporters are against a multiracial, multicultural society, the white nationalist people, and some of these Republicans probably are in that group, they're enraged that they're losing. You know, the country is you can't go back to the 1850s anymore, and the country is changing, and it will change. And the old white nationalist dream of white superiority and so forth is going to lose out in the long run, and they're desperate to hold on to it. And Trump, of course, is an example of that.
Well, it is definitely depressing, and you wonder whether the traditional Republicans are an endangered species, because I don't know whether that reflects the party that these people on the panel today. Except for Justin Amash, they were all, I thought, were just hysterical. And the only description that seems to fit is that they like sort of junkyard dogs, you know, like Hannity and Tucker Carlson on Fox. They're just angry and spewing out, you know, insane propaganda.
Well, I think it's probably a little bit also like what we were saying about Trump. As they feel more threatened, they become less and less rational. And I think that's true of Trump, and I think that's true of some of these people, too. I mean, if they were going to allow this testimony to stand without attacking the person saying it, it would be ruinous for them. So they're in deep trouble, and just as Trump is. Where are they going to stand if they've been supporters of him and their whole career depends on him? So I think that, yeah, and of course, in itself, that's a very selfish motivation, which is part of the problem that they share with Trump.
Thanks again
for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Lance Dodis, who's a training and supervising analyst emeritus with the Boston Psychoanalytic Society, an institute who was a clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Dodis is a contributor along with 36 other psychiatrists and mental health experts who have contributed to the new book, Assessing President Trump, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. 37 psychiatrists and mental health experts assess a president. We're going to take a brief station break, get an assessment of today's second summit meeting in Hanoi, Vietnam, between President Trump and Kim Jong-un.
That my love could hold you, I'm crazy for trying, and crazy for crying, and I'm crazy for loving you. Crazy for thinking that my
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Michael Fuchs, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs and was Special Advisor to the Secretary of State for Strategic Dialogues. He also served as a member of the Secretary's Policy Planning Staff. He co-authored The Survival and Success of Liberty, A Democracy Agenda for U.S. Foreign Policy with Morton Halperin, and he has an article at The Guardian, Is Progress with North Korea Possible Under Trump's Style of Diplomacy? Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Fuchs.
It's great to be back with you, Ian.
Well, thanks, and obviously the president has had his meetings with Kim Jong-un, but he's also, since it's late at night there in Hanoi, I assume he's been watching the Michael Cohen hearings, and he must feel that this, what's happening on Capitol Hill, is raining on his parade. But did you detect any progress from today's talks?
No progress that we've seen as of yet. Obviously, they've only just begun. They had a dinner together and a little bit of a meet and greet, but it sounds like the real substantive meetings are still to come. There are obviously a number of different rumors swirling around in the last 24 to 48 hours about what kind of deal may be coming out of Hanoi, but no authoritative sense yet as to whether or not they'll make progress. I think the real thing to be watching for, there are a number of different moving pieces, but I think that the real thing to be watching for is whether or not North Korea makes a specific commitment on its nuclear program or some aspect of it. In particular, Kim Jong-un, North Korean leader, had a few months ago put on the table publicly the idea of stopping the production of fissile material at its Yongbyon facility, which is one of its major facilities. So I think that that's something that the United States negotiators have been looking to try to secure, and that's what I would be looking for to see whether or not the president is able to get that tomorrow.
Well, the White House signaled that there were four points that, in fact, they almost implied that they were going to succeed in bringing about, one, a formal declaration ending the Korean War, two, the bringing back the remains of more U.S. servicemen who died in the Korean War, and closing down the Yongbyon facility so that the North Korea could not produce any more fissile material. And then in exchange for that, they would lift some sanctions, particularly those that would then enable North and South Korea to develop an economic, not a union, but develop their economies. So are those rumors or is there any substance to that? I mean, that's, if that happens, that's a big deal.
No, I think that's right. And I think that those four points, which again are being, I think a number of people are hearing the same thing, and there are a couple of reports in the last 24 hours indicating that those are the four areas of focus. I think that that's entirely possible. And I think that these are the things that we've been also hearing over the last, frankly, 10 months or so, that the North Koreans might be interested in, that the United States might be willing to put on the table. So the contents of those four points, I think, makes sense. I think the real question, again, though, is going to be the Yongbyon piece, this idea that the North Koreans will commit to taking some verifiable steps to stop the activities going on at the Yongbyon nuclear facilities, because this is a big deal. And if the Trump administration were able to get it, then I would say that is a good first step forward in this process, the first real one that we'd seen. But I think that it's still, you know, I won't believe it until I see it on a piece of paper agreed to by the two leaders. And even, frankly, then, if we get that commitment from the North Koreans, it's a good first step. But it's also just a promise on a piece of paper until you actually get inspectors there to verify what's happening there. So I think that that's, again, the thing to really watch for.
But how much plutonium do they have? In other words, how many warheads do they have already in their inventory, the North Koreans?
It's unclear based on, you know, what we know publicly. Their estimates are anywhere from a dozen to roughly 60. Nuclear weapons that they have the ability to actually have the material enough to actually make that number of nuclear weapons. So again, there's sort of a wide range of estimates in terms of what they are able to make. But obviously the fact that the Yongbyon facility is still running, it's still producing fissile material as far as we know. And that, of course, does not include potentially covert sites that they have elsewhere in the country. For this entire time, the North Koreans have been continuing to produce more material for potentially more nuclear weapons. And so, again, nothing has stopped, as far as we know yet, on that front.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Fuchs, who is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs and was Special Advisor to the Secretary of State for Strategic Dialogues. He also served as a member of the Secretary's Policy Planning Staff and co-authored The Survival and the Success of Liberty, A Democracy Agenda for U.S. Foreign Policy with Morton Halperin. And he has an article at The Guardian, Is Progress with North Korea Possible Under Trump's Style of Diplomacy? So I was just trying to establish with you, Michael, what the deterrence level that the North Koreans would settle for would be in terms of the number of warheads. Presumably that has to be a part of the discussion, doesn't it?
Well, I'm sure it's part of the consideration on the North Korean side. But I think what's important to focus on here is, again, this being just a first step. Obviously, the United States has, for a very long time, and continues to talk about the need for North Korea to denuclearize, you know, give up all of its nuclear weapons and its facilities. That's something that North Korea does not seem to want to do. And so, of course, the question has always been and still remains, what's the trade space in the, between those two extreme positions? And so I think that that's why we're seeing discussion focus on specific parts of the program to start. So if they were able to actually stop production at Yongbyon, that would be a very good first step if we were able to verify that. But, of course, one, they still have all the nuclear weapons that they currently have. Two, they actually, what most people believe, likely have other sites elsewhere in the country that are producing this kind of material they can use to make nuclear weapons. And so those would not be on the table unless they are included in this agreement. And so, again, I think that what we're talking about here is a piecemeal approach, a first step. And then, obviously, if that were to be successful, hopefully we would get to further steps. So the North Koreans are obviously thinking about how much they're willing to give up right now.
So since you worked in the Obama administration with Secretary of State on these issues directly, how did you respond to President Trump's remarks that the Obama administration is largely responsible for these tensions between North Korea? And if President Obama was still in office today, then we'd already be at war with North Korea.
I mean, these are lies from the president, of something we know that he likes to do very frequently on a wide range of topics. You know, this is the president being the arsonist and the firefighter at the same time. He likes to do it on other issues, and he loves to do it on North Korea. The president and President Trump and then President Obama had their first meeting 2 days after the election in the Oval Office, a tradition for all transitions. And reportedly out of that meeting, the president, President Obama, told President Trump at the time that North Korea would be one of his biggest challenges, which is an entirely accurate statement and continues to be an accurate assessment of the situation. President Trump, of course, started the following year in 2017 the uptick in rhetoric, fire and fury, talking about and sending very strong signals that the United States might actually attack North Korea. And regardless of whatever the level of threat is from North Korea, there was no fear in 2016 or, frankly, early 2017 or any time around then that there would be any kind of a war between the two countries. The Obama administration was not thinking anything like that. But it was President Trump who upped the ante on the rhetoric and gave everyone a real scare. Now, of course, a year later, he has engaged in diplomacy and is claiming to have solved this crisis that, of course, he created in the first place.
Yesterday, Michael Fuchs on the program, I talked with William Arkin, who also has an article about the North Korean nuclear program and the talks underway in Hanoi at The Guardian. And he makes the argument that we shouldn't be quick to dismiss Trump as being fatuous and having yet another photo opportunity and only be interested in his ego-driven agenda of getting a Nobel Prize. What's your response to that? Because one of the things that he said that I thought made a lot of sense, I asked him about whether there was a risk that Kim Jong-un had, which is if you end the Korean War and start integrating your economy with the South, the prosperous South, and the absolutely devastated, you know, dead zone in the North, won't that have the effect of the North Korean people finding out how badly off they are and how much better off the people in the South are and how they've been lied to for decades. And he said, well, we essentially, the United States has two choices. Do you follow the Iraq model of confrontation, which we know how disastrous that was, or do you follow the East German model, which is what essentially I was just sort of outlining. So do you see those choices, and do you think there's a way to follow the East German model of soft power persuasion?
Well, I think on the first point, it's important to note, as I do as much as possible, that diplomacy with North Korea is necessary. And while I don't think that Trump is a good president, and I don't think that, frankly, he's a good diplomat or a good negotiator, and while I would, having gone about this kind of engagement with North Korea very differently, diplomacy is the right thing to be doing. It's the only way we're going to address this problem, if we're ever going to. And so I think that that part of his strategy with North Korea is good. I think that if he's able to show out of this diplomacy, including in the next 24 hours in Hanoi, some actual progress on the nuclear front, then we'll see that maybe there is actually some progress to be made in the style of diplomacy that the president is engaged in right now. I'm not holding my breath for it, but, you know, I am hoping that there is progress. When it comes to the future for the two Koreas, I think that this is, of course, us getting way ahead of ourselves. Any future relationship between North and South Korea is something that is very, very far off in the distance. The types of steps that the two countries have taken in the last year at détente are positive steps, without a doubt, but very, very small baby steps there. And so I think that the questions raised about Kim Jong-un losing control of a economic liberalization process and integration and so forth is absolutely a key fear that he has. But I also think, again, that, if ever, is very, very far off. And frankly, maybe we'd be lucky to be having to deal with those problems rather than the ones we're dealing with now.
Well, what I find extraordinary, though, and I'm wondering whether it's necessary, the extent to which Donald Trump praises Kim Jong-un, and, you know, he said he loves the guy and he got a love letter from him, and now he's calling him his friend. And this guy runs one of the world's worst regimes, the most repressive. It's a combination of a cult and an organized crime family. It's just absolutely hideous what's been going on in that country for decades. And obviously, the more he praises Kim Jong-un, who murdered his own half-brother with a weapon of mass destruction, I might add, who kills his opponents by shooting any aircraft weapons at them, blowing them to pieces. This is who this guy is. So do you think that Trump, one, do you think it's necessary to stroke this guy's ego in order to get a deal out of him? Or two, do you think that the price we pay for the United States abandoning its position as a champion of human rights on the global stage is worth it?
No, it's not worth it. And I think that the president, not only does it, I think it not help in the negotiations with North Korea, I think, frankly, it hurts because I think it makes the president look weak. I think it makes him look like he is being, frankly, taken for a ride by Kim Jong-un. And Kim Jong-un and the North Korean officials will notice that. And so I think that, without a doubt, this is one of the most disgusting things that, frankly, I think I've seen from an American president in terms of foreign policy in recent decades. But I think it's also important to note at the same time that what President Trump is doing in praising Kim Jong-un, of course, is not real diplomacy here. It's okay, and again, necessary to engage in real diplomacy with our enemies, with countries that do awful things. That's just the reality of it. We've got problems with North Korea, real threats. We need to engage with them diplomatically, regardless of the horrible, horrible things that they do. But the way in which this president is doing it, first and foremost, by praising this dictator on a regular basis, again, is not only disgusting, and again, goes against everything that I think America stands for in the world, but also, again, is, I think, actually counterproductive to getting something real done with North Korea.
Well, what's going on, though, with the intel that Trump is getting? We know from McCabe's testimony, or at least his appearance on 60 Minutes, where he said that, you know, Trump was getting a briefing from his intelligence officials and over the threat from North Korea, and he dismissed the concerns of our intelligence community that the North Koreans have ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons that could reach the west coast of the United States. And he said, no, that's not true. Putin told me they don't have that capability. And they said, but we're telling you he does. And then he said, I believe Putin, not you guys. So that's pretty bad. But now you have a situation where he continues to say he's getting information from Putin and I guess from Xi Jinping as well. Just the day before Trump arrived in Hanoi, I think it was, the Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov was there. So what's going on there? Do you think any American president is making any deal with any world leader would normally be in constant contact with his intelligence people and be getting briefings all the time. And this guy is not getting those kind of briefings. And so does that mean that he is subject to Russia's and China's agenda along with Kim Jong-un's agenda?
Well, the idea of Vladimir Putin giving Donald Trump advice on North Korea is just multiple levels of confusing and disturbing at the same time. And obviously, there's a whole other host of issues that we could go into right there. But I think fundamentally, the problem, of course, is with the way this president acts. And it's true on North Korea, but it's true on most other things as well. He believes that, as he said, he alone can solve big problems like this. I think it's why we see the president last year, why we saw him last year jump and push the idea of a summit meeting with Kim Jong-un. That was something, by the way, that when the North Koreans came to the United States and said that they'd be interested in diplomacy, as far as we can tell, no one had talked about a summit meeting. President Trump's agreement to do that was something that surprised everybody. And it's, again, his rush to do another summit meeting right now, I think, is evident of President Trump's style. Regardless of facts, regardless of the realities of any situation, North Korea or otherwise, he believes that he personally can solve it. It's his gut, as he's sort of described it before. And so I think that here it's absolutely terrifying, obviously, but it's the reality that we're living with. This president believes that if he gets in the room with Kim Jong-un, that some sort of positive relationship with them can bring about what President Trump wants.
Well, just in closing, Trump did ask for this second summit, too. And he clearly, as a politician, he needs a win. So there's a great deal of suspicion that that may be as much of a motive for domestic consumption to look good in an administration that's just flaying about. So without being too cynical, I guess I should end on that note.
I would just say that I think that's exactly right. And I think right before President Trump left for Hanoi, he made it very, very clear to the American people by saying the soft part loud when he said that as long as Kim Jong-un is not testing, I'm happy. And right there you have it. And you ask, begs the question, why would Kim Jong-un give up anything more?
Well, Michael Fuchs, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Fuchs, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs and was Special Advisor to the Secretary of State for Strategic Dialogues. He also served as a member of the Secretary's Policy Planning Staff and co-authored The Survival and the Success of Liberty, A Democracy Agenda for U.S. Foreign Policy with Morton Halperin. And he has an article at The Guardian, Is Progress with North Korea Possible Under Trump's Style of Diplomacy? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.
dressed in white with the man she loved.